Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started here. Welcome back from the break, folks, and excited to introduce our next speaker this morning, Jim Akin from Barr Engineering Company. Title of his presentation is Assessing Potential Effects from Mine Dewatering at a Proposed Aggregate Mine Site Using Groundwater and Surface Water Modeling.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming to this auspicious event. My name is Jim Akin. I'm a hydrogeologist at Barr, based in Minneapolis here. I'm pleased to be here and talk about a bit more of a policy-related presentation today. And the reason that I'm interested in this topic is because I've done quite a bit of work in litigation and expert testimony, particularly regarding environmental review. If I could just get a show of hands, how many of you, I know from earlier that there's a lot of geologists in the crowd, but how many of you have worked on an environmental assessment worksheet or an environmental impact statement? Great. My hope is there's something for everyone here, a little bit of basic information, but also some insight as how we as technical professionals and scientists can do a better job of communicating some of the environmental effects that are often considered as part of environmental review for some of these projects. Bearing in mind that the goal is to really balance the need to protect our environment with also a vital need to make sure we ensure economic vitality of our state. I'd like to thank my co-author, Kirsten Pauley, who could not be here today. Kirsten is president of Sundy Engineering, and they are a real powerhouse in the aggregate mining industry, and particularly environmental review. It's been our pleasure. Barr is very grateful to partner with Sundy on this project. And they asked us, on behalf of their client, to help them with their environmental impact statement for a mining project in Scott County. And I am advancing slides. First, I'd like to make some acknowledgments. Of course, Sundy Engineering, our client, our granting and funding agency for this project is our client, Brian Rock Products, and their partner, Malkerson Sales, as well early in the project, Midwest Sales, who is the operator of the Renaissance Festival, was also involved in the project. We thank them. And in particular, Louisville Township and Scott County Environmental Services. They did a wonderful job on this and really have a lot to be proud of. If you're interested in finding out more about this very detailed EIS, please go to Scott County website, and that EIS is still posted there. I'd also like to acknowledge our hydrogeologic team at Barr Engineering, both past and present, and particularly my colleague, late Dave Dahlstrom, who passed away a couple years ago. Dave was really one of those unique talents that blended really exceptional field instincts and technical knowledge with computational hydrogeology and modeling, and really benefited from his participation in this project. So I'm going to start with the end in mind. My hope is that the takeaway that you get today is that when we're talking about environmental review, and I'll give you a little background on that, not all environmental effects are significant. And this is important because when you're presenting technical information to the public and whether or not there's going to be environmental effect, most times it's a zero or one yes or no answer to most people play. If there's any environmental effect, people will tend to assume that that's a bad thing and that you have to do something about it. And what the environmental rules are actually set up to do is to provide information for people so that they can understand what is really a gray area. It's never a zero or one answer. It's always a judgment call based on the overall information that's being presented. And the main thing I'm hoping to talk about today is using a little bit different type of approach in helping the public understand what the effects of a proposed dewatering operation look like, in this case for a dolostone quarry and proposed frac sand mine. I'll start off right away. The frac sand mine never happened. The mine was permitted for the dolostone, which in the industry they call limestone, typically, although it's a dolomitic carbonate rock. But the frac sand piece of it was where the dewatering was involved, and that actually never materialized because the whole frac sand market crashed, at least in the Midwest, right around 2017. So we're going to first of all start with the project site. We're located here in northwestern Scott County, just south of the Twin Cities metro area. On the top north side of the project site, you've got Chaska, Shakopee to the northeast, and Jordan to the south. In between here is the Minnesota River Valley. And this mine area is a large mine site, approximately 682 acres at full development. And I think it's interesting to note the timeline. There's a lot of reasons why this project took almost 10 years to complete environmental review. It wasn't because of the any delay created by the RGU, in this case Scott County. It was a lot of starts and stops related to the ownership group. And so you can see our field work started in about 2011, and then it culminated in July of 2020 with a decision of adequacy on the EIS by the Scott County Board. So the mine situation is really interesting because this is a terrace deposit with the Prairie du Chien group, Shakopee and Oneota formations, forming a resistant upland in the Minnesota River Valley. It's a historical mine area. This rock is very competent. It's used in aggregate. Aggregate is the most common building product made in the United States year after year because it is incorporated into concrete. So you've got the plan was to create a 1.2 million ton per year frac sand mine in a 50 or more year deposit. So this is a pretty ambitious project, and one that really was about trying to get the dolomite out, but using that mining activity to get to the sandstone underneath. The original concept of this was intentionally planned to avoid impacts to groundwater. So the mining of the Jordan sandstone, which is very uniform, well-rounded sandstone that's friable in this area, the mining of that was intended to be done with hydraulic dredging, not dewatering. However, the dewatering is important to get through and blast out the dolostone above. So that's what we call the dry mining part, hydraulic dredging. And then because there was a multi-ownership group, the phasing was somewhat complicated. They had different parts of the site were going to be mined by different times and placed in these wash and dry plants for shipment via rail. The reclamation plan was primarily open water with some backfill. So the essence of environmental review when it comes to mining is Minnesota Rules Chapter 4410. And in that rule body, the intent is to provide information for decision makers and the public so they can better understand what the possible environmental effects of a proposed project might be. So in the rule itself, the goal is to identify significant environmental effects. And this is important because there are many, many environmental effects from every single activity that we humans engage in. And so the key is to identify those effects that are the most significant so that they can be addressed by preferably through the permit process. This involves an environmental assessment worksheet, which is kind of the preliminary part. And because we're doing an EIS in this case, the environmental assessment worksheet, which is a simple, straightforward assessment of all the of general information, more of a desktop type review, it was used as a scoping document to put forward the ideas that were going to be used in the EIS. So this is really key. In terms, as a geologist, professional geologist, licensed professional, establishing a standard of care is kind of the gold standard for us. That is a basis for which we can make judgments and opinions given the data that we collect. And the first place we always look is the rules. And as part of the litigation that I did, we did a deep dive on some of these rules and how they can be applied to making decisions about potential effects due to dewatering. So the first term you need to understand is effect, which is any notable change due to a project, can be any kind of effect. In the rules, they define a significant effect as really falling into a specific category of effects. First, it must be adverse, it must be irreversible, It must not be subject to ongoing regulatory authority or the potential for mitigation, because if you can regulate it or mitigate it, the thinking is it cannot, at the end of the day, be significant. Now, there's another term, a middle bucket, that I like to use called an impact. Now, this is not to be confused. In the rules, they talk about cumulative impacts, and quite frankly, impact and effect are used interchangeably throughout the rule and in the guidance. What we are trying to do is establish this middle ground between an effect and a significant effect that we call an impact. So an impact is something that appears to have a potentially significant effect on something, but we haven't yet applied the rules to determine if there's a mitigation or a regulatory authority or whether or not it's reversible. So I'll talk about a little bit about our investigation, which included a pretty detailed site characterization. Essentially, we used rotosonic borings to get a really good sense of the geology at the site, and as well conducted pumping tests and, of course, baseline monitoring. And then, because wetlands are such a key part of this investigation, being connected to the Minnesota River, we did a lot of monitoring in these wetlands. Essentially, the goal was to create a robust conceptual site model, or CSM, that we could use to build the groundwater flow model. So conceptually, our site model really consists of these terrace deposits, including the Prairie du Chien, and above the Minnesota River, with flow happening on several scales. One is the local flow, feeding a lot of the wetlands, but also these deeper regional flow paths, also from recharge from farther away, trying to discharge into the Minnesota River Valley. The groundwater flow model itself, for those of you who are modeling gearheads, there's something for everybody in this talk. So this project was started in 2011. So the latest and greatest version of ModFlow is ModFlow NWT. And we were using, at that time, Metro Model 2 as our far field, which is a term that we use to describe our site model is carved out of that larger metro model. So all of the activities going on in the entire basin that are characterized in the metro model are still out there for us to use as boundary conditions for our local model. And we refine that mesh down to the site scale. We used the river package for the Minnesota River and the drain package and ModFlow for the wetlands. Baseline water quality data and monitoring data were collected for 2 years. We actually were able to collect additional monitoring data. If I could also make one pitch here for environmental review and permitting purposes, there is no such thing as too much baseline data. What you want to try to do is to incorporate as much drought signal as you possibly can. The model is calibrated to these data. It was weighted by proximity to the site. We used pumping test data to parameterize the model, and of course, used a lot of inverse modeling to optimize those parameter results to get the best fit in our calibration. And if you're not a modeling person, what you need to know is that typically, groundwater flow models provide two types of output. One is the flux into or out of parts of the model. It's basically an accounting software in that mode. And the other is head data, so it models the water table condition, in this case, across the site. And these are really important because when we talk about water resources and the issues that come up, we really had four primary water resources out here, and you'll see them throughout here. The most important one to note was this seepage wetland, which is located closest to the mine area, and because it's fed primarily with groundwater, was the cause of a lot of interest in our environmental review process. What's unique about this project is that we're able to marry two types of models together. One is XP-SWIM, which is a surface water model. The other is ModFlow. And the reason we were doing XP-SWIM was because there was a lot of concern about the Minnesota Valley Recreational Area, otherwise known as Louisville Swamp. In this area, in this part of the region, this is a huge priority, and maintaining the vitality of this wetland is really key. So we wanted to understand a little bit about how it was connected to surface water. And what we found from doing XP-SWIM and going through all the stage data from the Minnesota River is that on an annual basis, the probability that the Louisville Swamp would be inundated by the river is about 90%. So most years, Louisville Swamp is getting a lot of water from Minnesota River. On the other hand, this is in contrast to the seepage wetland, which it's not shown here, but I believe it was on the order of 10 to 15% of the time, on an annual basis, it would be have a probability of being inundated by the river. So generally speaking, our model results show groundwater flow to the river from upland areas towards the west to the river, not a surprise there. One of the things that we often do with groundwater models is use head data or drawdown data. And in this case, these yellow contours represent different levels. This is a 5-foot decline of simulated head or forecasted head decline. This is 10, 15, etc. So there's a change. Instead of the water going to the river now, you see a lot of water going to the mine area as a result of our dewatering, which, by the way, was only a 5-foot change in head. So you got all these wells here. How do you determine if any of those wells are likely to be affected by dewatering? Well, it's pretty straightforward. You can use groundwater data or the predicted water level decline really easily by looking at the well construction records. So if the water level decline is puts the dewatering level close to where the pump intake is, that's probably a problem and you need it. So of all those wells that we had, which by the way, all these wells here, Sunday went through and looked at each of the well records for these, and they came up with just a handful of these wells that were likely to be at risk in the context of the mining operation. So pretty straightforward. You've got an effect, which is the dewatering effect. You've got a potential impact in that you've identified wells that could be dried up or at least diminished in their ability to provide water. So that's an impact in our definition. So we had that impact. Now what we look at is what can we do about it? So in our case, it's a pretty simple solution. You'd come up with a developer agreement. You work out a deal with the landowner. If there's a problem, we will replace your pump. The county pointed out that, boy, we really don't want to have people drying their wells up so that, you know, that causes the alarm. That's going to cause a lot of problems for folks at the DNR and the county, et cetera. But so we installed monitoring throughout that area so that we would be able to have an early warning system. And that is part of mitigation so that you can jump in there and solve a problem before it becomes an issue for people. So that's an example of a really straightforward way to use the modeling results and to assess the potential for significant effects. When it comes to water bodies and wetlands, it's a little different story. The problem is, what does a 5 or even a 25-foot decline in head level or water level mean to a wetland body? And the answer is, it kind of depends. Depends on where it is and how it's fed. So what we did was we looked at our conceptual model, which for review has got these multiple scales of flow, reaching wetlands and reaching the fluvial deposits. And what we found, it was a bit of a surprise, even we're talking about a 5-foot decline in head, basically short-circuited the entire local flow system in the Jordan. So all of the water that was previously going to the wetlands, or not all of it, but a lot of the water that was previously going to the wetlands is now going into this mine pit. And also, in addition to that, some of the gradient is being reversed so that water is going away from the fluvial deposits into the mine pit. So we've got a short circuit there. Obviously, we've got an effect. So looking at whether or not these various water bodies are going to be impacted by that effect is where we used a water balance approach and integrated the XB swim data that we had, which basically is more accounting. I'd like to say that there's some really sophisticated math, but it's basically addition and subtraction, which even I as a geologist can handle. So what we did is we looked at the water balance for each of these wetlands in the XB swim model. We had to do a little bit of derivation for the seepage wetland because it wasn't explicit in the model. We had to use the runoff area, sort of local watershed, to derive some of the values. We did have a value for groundwater input into the water balance, and we were able to come up with a water balance for each of these water bodies that we then compared to our the flux out of those bodies during the modeling effort. So we've got a seepage wetland that's receiving flow, and I think the important thing to note here is there's run on into the seepage wetland, even though it's fed by groundwater, and the seepage wetland has runoff out. So these are flow-through wetlands. The wetlands start in the higher parts of the site topographically, and water is transferred, essentially groundwater transfer is turned into surface water, and then that flows into wetlands downhill from it. So that's kind of the conceptual model that came out of that. And I won't get into a lot of the detail here. We did a lot of different analyses for different scenarios, so I tried to summarize these here. And essentially what we found that 26% of the total water balance for Gifford Lake and 63% of the water balance for the seepage wetland are from groundwater. And that's indicated by these little pie charts and kind of gives you a sense for how much the missing pie is where the groundwater is. So why that's important is because when we applied the groundwater modeling and the flux calculations, we found that the dewatering for the seepage wetland removed 100% of that 63%. So all of that water is gone, so we're at a minus 63% deficit. Notably, Gifford Lake, much less, but still some groundwater influence from the proposed dewatering operation. And Louisville Swamp actually is a net recharger to groundwater, so there's quite a bit of available recharge available. And I think it's probably important to note that one of our conclusions from this water balance is that if there's excess water flowing out of a wetland, that and you've appropriately counted for evapotranspiration for all the healthful needs of that of the plant life in that wetland, then that extra water that's flowing out becomes water that's available in the sort of checking account for you to pull from the groundwater system and use and take out in the dewatering. So that was kind of a fundamental aspect to that. So obviously, we've got a problem at the seepage wetland for sure. There's more water coming out of that wetland. It's not going to survive if we don't do something about it. It's a impact. So what are some of the things you can do about it? We looked at a lot of different options, including some that were very, very expensive. And this is the one that we kind of homed in on. And there's precedent for this type of application at other mine sites. But the idea is an infiltration gallery. So we're gonna take that dewatering, that cold groundwater that we're pumping out of the mine pit, and we're gonna re-inject it uphill from the seepage wetland. And we're going to let that water seep into the seepage wetland and replace the water that's being pulled out from underneath it. And when we do that calculation, what we end up with is that we have an excess of water available to that seepage wetland. So we can even address drought conditions and anything else that comes up by providing more water to that seepage wetland. We also have about 30% excess water that we'd have to do something else with, which, of course, we've got wash operations. And there was always that 26% from Gifford Lake. Gifford Lake is basically a backwater lake. It's really shallow. It's notable for its amazing carp breeding capabilities. If you ever go down there in the spring, it's pretty interesting to see all the activity that the carp are engaged in. But anyway, so there's lots of water for us to use for other purposes. This is just kind of a summary. Without mitigation, you've got a lot of your pie missing, but with mitigation, you've got your full amount of water plus any extra water that you can use for other purposes. And the question did come up, you know, gee, is it a bad thing to put water into wetland? And Dan Tix, who is our wetland specialist on this project, now with Prairie Restoration, said, in his very quiet, understated manner, so generally speaking, an abundance of water is not normally a problem for a wetland. Which is one of my favorite quotes from the project. Anyway, so in summary, not all potential environmental effects are significant in the context of the rules. So why is this important? Because as professionals, we have to have a basis for our conclusions, and the rules give us that basis. In the rules, significance is defined. It is my experience, and the reason I'm here is because too often, those definitions are ignored, and significance kind of becomes whatever the public or stakeholders really want it to be. And what we have to do is remind people that the rule is clear, and what we have is our mission, and whether or not something significant depends on whether that impact can be moderated, mitigated, regulated. So the other thing I'd like to take away is that the model forecasts just using the head levels and predicting a decline can be useful for some things, but in other cases, it leaves too much to the imagination for stakeholders. Using the water balance method that we used in this site, I think is a very valuable tool for helping to provide that context of what a significant impact is to water body. And therefore, using models, we can do a lot better job of informing the public on what significant really means from the water resources perspective. With that, I'll take any questions that you might have.
Hi there. Thanks. Very interesting. Just a question about what looks to be a fen there, that wetland, although I didn't hear that word used.
It is not.
It's not a fen.
It is not a fen. It is a fresh meadow shrub car complex that does not meet the definition of a calcareous fen, and that's per the DNR's review as well.
Oh, so. That's good. The same question I have about what would happen if you're going to be extracting groundwater and then infiltrating it, you're going to be oxygenating that groundwater that you bring out. What do you think could be some geochemical ramifications on the geochemistry of that wetland from doing that?
Well, one of the benefits of the infiltration, the exfiltration trench, if you will, is that you are in a relatively rapid turnaround, putting that water back into the ground and letting it slowly seep into the ground. In this case, because it's a seepage wetland, it wasn't as critical to make sure that the chemistry identically matched the water coming into the fen. But I will offer that for other projects that I have that do involve calcareous fens, the number one challenge that we face is that it's very, very difficult to accurately monitor a calcareous fen without concerns that you're going to somehow impact the fen based on your investigation. And so what I would say is we need a lot more research into these fens and the chemistry, because I think there's a wide range of disagreement on how much the water quality can change relative to what actually gets into the fen. We just don't have the data to lean on to let us know what the limits are, especially for those calcareous fens. In this case, the folks that were involved in this did not believe that this particular wetland would be as sensitive to those geochemical changes.
Thank you. Sorry. I have a non-technical question.
Great. Where are you?
Over here. Sorry.
Oh.
I'm just wondering if you could speak to like communication strategies around the project, because so you use the word significant a lot, and I think that we all know what that means. Mm-hmm. But if you're living right next to the wetland, or if you're living, you know, with anything, and it kind of like risk communication. A small risk to one person is different than a small risk to other people. It's different than the person living there versus somebody in an office in another state. You know, how do we kind of say like, there's an impact here, we don't view it as significant, but we also hear your concerns, and you know, yeah, could you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good question. It's really at the core to this talk, which is that everybody has a different tolerance. Everybody thinks they know what significance means, but very few people can agree on exactly what it means in the context of our observations. However, I will say that in Scott County, they were very sensitive to the thoughts and beliefs of the folks that were out there, and a lot of your job and my job for this project was education. And so you cannot communicate too much. It's really important to let people know what these things are and what they mean. For example, the idea that, you know, ModFlow can measure change in head down to a thousandth of a foot. And the problem that we ran into was, on the one hand, There was concern from the client about saying that the model wasn't accurate, but on the other hand, trying to give a realistic sense for what the limits of modeling can actually do. I mean, models are useful, but they're usually not quite right. They're intended to give you a sense or a forecast, kind of like the weather. Sometimes you get more snow than you expected. Does that mean the model's wrong? It means there's variation in the system that you haven't quite characterized. So that's just an example of how there's a discussion to be had with folks. And I think in Minnesota, we have a very educated populace. I've always had really good luck with workshops and presentations and getting people to know. Thank you.
Jim, I have one question. Could you go back to one of your first slides? This is more of a general question, but just if you have any insight to the plan, a site map, cross-section. Right here. In any of your work with quarries, have you seen any kind of guideline as far as that setback distance? You see there, it's 30 feet, and then you have a 20-foot wide bench. As far as the setback distance relative to the depth of the quarry, the depth of the cut?
I think, you know, to answer your question on setbacks generally, a lot of it's driven by the local ordinance. I don't know that there's a standard rule of thumb. A lot of ordinance actually require a 1,000-foot setback. And in fact, in the frac sand rules, there was a 1,000-foot setback proposed in southeastern Minnesota. What these mostly represent is our client Brian Rock's historical experience working with these particular slopes and what was constituted a decent safety bench and property setbacks. Where we did studies on the geotechnical basis was on the railroad tracks, because this whole site has a railroad track going through it, and the idea that you're going to be mining friable sandstone and have a Canadian Pacific train dump into the lake was actually a concern that was raised. So we did some geotechnical modeling to come up with a safe slope stability that would allow for mining of the sandstone underneath.
So is like a 1-to-1 or 1.5-to-1 or?
We started with roughly a 3-to-1 angle of repose. And then what we found from a modeling is that you can actually go steeper underwater because of the confining pressure of the water itself.
All right, thanks.
Jim, there were two wetlands, correct?
There's actually four public water wetlands.
Okay, and I think if I saw on one of your slides, the drawdown below one of the wetlands was about 15 feet predicted by
the model. That's correct, yeah.
Okay, but there was very little effect or impact to that wetland.
Yes.
Why is that?
Mostly that's because of the additional water that's being provided from surface water. So, for example, Louisville Swamp. It gets almost 13,000 acre feet a year from surface water, so much so that in the water balance, it's actually a recharge to groundwater. So it's providing water to groundwater. The other ones like Gifford Lake, it's got an inlet for surface water. When the elevation reaches a certain height, it just fills with water. But then it also relies on some groundwater as well. So what you're pointing out is really the key struggle, and if you look at DNR guidance, there's even guidance on appropriate water levels, you know, that can drop from a project and things like that. But in this case, really what it comes down to is understanding where the water's coming from for that particular water body.
Okay, and did you use a vertical K then for the material underneath that?
Yeah.
What was that?
In the drain package, I believe there is a conductance value at the base so that you have to define that. And we didn't have a lot of field data on that. A lot of that was parametized by inverse modeling. Okay. So a best fit to the data.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Got time for one more question?
Yeah, just speak up and I'll try to repeat. No, it's from the rules. So the question was, is the definition of significant effect ginned up by a lawyer or else? And so I mentioned the litigation that I was a part of. So I've been part of a couple of different lawsuits that contested a decision for an EIS, mostly related to landfills. So I worked with an attorney named Matt Slavin, who's currently with MV Ventures, which is the Minnesota Vikings real estate group. And Matt put forward a legal argument that identified how the rule definition is stated in Minnesota Rules 4410-1700. So that's where you can find that definition. And because there's a legal principle that a definition in one part of the rule can be used throughout the rest of the rule, that's why it can be applied to as a test for an EIS. That definition of significance in the actual rules is related to the, it gives guidance on how to determine whether an EIS is necessary. But what the novelty was that he, that really Matt pointed out was that as a legal principle, a definition in the rules is a definition in the rules. You can use it for any other part of the rule. So really good question. Right. So the question is, does it define regulated? And would those, and there's a lot of different ways to regulate things, would that make it exempt? And the answer is that the rule does not provide a lot of guidance on that. It says that it can't be significant if it's subject to ongoing regulatory authority. So the classic would be a situation where you've got a stormwater permit and somebody says, well, this, you're gonna have a lot of runoff. Well, what the proposer could point to is that stormwater is regulated by the MCCA under the stormwater rules. And so therefore they have to meet those rules that prevents by law them from having that particular impact, and therefore it cannot be significant. So that's the logic behind it. There's quite a bit of disagreement though on what constitutes it. I believe in this case, regulatory authority couldn't really help a wetland. You know, it can't really help a seepage wetland replace its groundwater. There's just no way. Eventually that wetland's gonna dry up and it's gonna be replaced in vegetation, causing a permanent change. So mitigation really was the only option there in my view. Yeah, it is open to the, and my hope is that providing these definitions will give you as professionals and policymakers a basis for making your decisions, which at the heart of it is the essential element of what's called a professional standard of care. And as a consultant, we're really interested in that because if we don't demonstrate that, we're not insurable. So it's really, on a lot of levels, it's really key, not only in communicating to the public, but also in making sure that what you're doing is professionally sound and adequate in protecting the health, life, and welfare of our state. Thank you.